You're a person on your team.
So I get the honor of introducing one of my favorite people in the field. So Kate Ward, I first met Kate through the Library of Congress a number of years ago when I was there doing teaching work with the Library of Congress. And I was struck immediately by the degree to which Kate, unlike many of her peers even at the Library of Congress, where I think there is a lot of brilliance, especially in the interviews that I got to see, there's a lot there. There's a lot of brilliance. But even among them, she was a standout. And some of the reason was because she penetrated through the cultural heritage piece of the puzzle by really looking at what it meant from a digital standpoint to think about preservation, to think about access, and to think about how to make that happen in the Library of Congress context, where it has not been one of the priority arenas until recently. So Kate and I have shared several years of journey together now, and what I can say is that the comments that she's already made during this two-day event, I think, already give you a good introduction to Kate and some of the things that she's thinking about, including how to bring together practicing hackers, how to bring together different components within both the journalism and data world and the data and preservation world and the strength that archiving can bring into that. So with that said, Kate.
So much for that warm introduction. Hey everybody, how you doing? I feel like I'm standing between you and your coffee at this point. But I'll try to make it lively and interesting. And hello to all the people who are watching the live stream from their homes or offices. I just want to start with a quick caveat that I'm not here talking on behalf of the Library of Congress when I'm expressing my personal opinion. I'm using experience that I learned there. I'll be talking about a few things that I think, and it's not the official position of the Library of Congress, just to state that. A little bit about my background is I'm a software developer, and I've come to libraries as sort of my adopted home that I love very much. But my undergraduate degree is in journalism and statistics, so news is really where my heart is, so I'm really excited to be here today to talk to you about this. We have a little bit of time together. We've got about half an hour. My talk is pretty dense with information, so I'll be like looking at your faces. Please use your bodies to indicate to me how it's going, and if there's something that I'm talking about that's not quite landing, I can explain a little bit more. I'm going to start a little bit with talking about my team, which is brand new, just to give you some context into what I do at the library and how I think that we can help. Excuse me, I've had bronchitis for 3 weeks, so it's a little bit rusty. And then I'll go into some things that I think about in terms of emerging standards, tooling, partnerships and friendships that I think can help us all move together in this space. So, let me first start with my team. We're very small. Like I said, we're not quite a year old yet, we're interested in doing some exciting things. Before I get into the nitty-gritty about what we're working on, I'd like to start with a quick story. So Henriette Avram, who in the room has heard of this person? Oh, great, awesome. I'm so excited. She was born in 1919 in New York. She did 2 years of pre-med at Hunter College and then left to start a family. When she was about 30 years old, she started programming, which I think is really cool because there are still some people who will tell you if you haven't been writing code since you were a baby, that you'll never make it as a programmer. And I'm here to tell you that they're wrong. She did, and she changed the world. So Henriette invented the MARC cataloging standard. Who in the room does not remember using a card catalog? Everybody remembers these? So she invented the format that made it possible to do precision searching and searching at a distance. I love the way card catalogs smell, but I don't really miss anything else about them. Searching is much, much better. And she did this in the late 1960s. And, you know, to give you some context for, like, the other nerds in the room, this was a time before relational databases, before computer networking, and before character encoding standards were really mature. So this was a sea change. And what I think is really interesting about her story is that she did this with the power of cross-disciplinary fertilization. She was not a librarian by training. She was a software developer. And she came in to the Library of Congress with that perspective. And she saw the future of how computers were going to be used around information. At that time, computers and libraries were accounting for accounting, right? They weren't used for information sharing. And because she had that unique perspective, she was able to cause this sea change that has affected all of our lives here today. And I think about this in context of this room here and what we might be able to do with sharing our different perspectives and cause the same kind of sea change. So a little bit about my group, National Digital Initiatives. We have a couple of goals. And I want to tell you about this because there's been some talk today about school and yesterday about the Library of Congress, what the Library of Congress can do. I'm not in the Copyright Office. I don't make acquisition decisions. But I do have the power to encourage some collaborations and to incubate new projects. So if that's the kind of thing that you're interested in, I want to talk about that as a possibility. So our first goal is to maximize the value of the digital collection. So we have a lot of stuff at the Library of Congress, a lot of it's digital. We want to think about how we can squeeze all the juice out of the orange. So how can we encourage digital humanities type of research? How can we reach out to universities and make sure that they're making use of our information? How do we reach lifelong learners? How do we talk to journalists to make sure that they're using our resources when it's applicable to them and they understand the value that reference can bring to their stories? So that's what it is. We also want to encourage creative reuse. The Library of Congress has a bunch of photographs up on Flickr, and one of the neat things that kind of came out of this project was people started tagging the awesome mustaches. And it's fun, right? And it's fun and it brings an attention to the collection. But it can also serve a scholarly importance, a purpose that's of scholarly importance too. So the Library of Congress has on loan the Rosa Parks collection, which is a huge treasure trove of manuscripts and photographs documenting her personal life and her work on behalf of civil rights for African Americans. And it contains this handwritten note to her friend, which says, "I have been pushed around all my life and felt at this moment I couldn't take it anymore." And this gives us a window into her as an American hero in that moment. But other pieces help us understand her as a human, as a friend, as a family member. And that's really valuable too. And that's why I love her pancake recipe. I've heard that it makes really great pancakes, but it also shows us that she was a person, right? And that we have the moral obligation to make those kind of decisions in the moment too, that she wasn't an icon frozen in time. The second thing that my little team is doing is to incubate, encourage, and promote digital innovation. I used to call us the semi-permeable membrane, but that got a lot of weird looks, so I definitely am not there anymore. Don't tell them. But I think there's a lot of exciting work going on in the Library of Congress. It's really big, and it's hard for people to get a glimpse into some things that are also going on in, like, the production side of the world. And I'd like to help that information flow out a little bit better, but also I want to help information flow in. So there's a lot of our staff is focused on the production nature of their work, right? They've got work to do. They don't have time to go to conferences. And what I can do is help introduce those folks to some people out in the field doing work that's similar that they could benefit from. Also, I think we could act as a catalyst. Who loves chemistry? I love chemistry too. So this is, I'm putting in an energy diagram here. This is, as you all know, an energy diagram of an exothermic reaction. Right? And exothermic reactions are spontaneous, which means they happen automatically, but not if it requires an activation energy. And I think about a lot of our products, our projects, as things like that too, that we're excited about, that we're like crowdsourcing in libraries, right? We want to do it, but we need a little bit of push to get off the to get over that hump. We're not enzymes. I mean, they enable life, so I can't say that we're that good. But what we can do is provide a little bit of technical expertise, provide some context to other people, show folks some open source projects that might be relevant. So that's the effort I think that can get us over that little hump. So I'll tell you a few things that we've done in our first year. One of the things is we co-hosted DiplaFest, which is really exciting. The other thing is we co-hosted a hackathon that Matt Weber and two of his colleagues organized. It was super fun. One of the things I really loved is that they were very intentional about opening it up to programmers and also scholars and librarians. And when I talked earlier about that cross-discipline fertilization, I really was struck by the value of it there. Having librarians in the room who understood the data sets intimately was hugely helpful to the scholars, and I think it really illustrates the evolving shape of reference. It was super cool, and I hope we can do it again. We're also working on a digital scholars lab. So the Library of Congress is a little bit different from most large libraries. We're not attached to an academic institution, so we don't have students, and we don't have faculty members that we can partner with. But we do have John W. Kluge Center. So that's a place where scholars come from all around the world to be in residence at the library for a little while, to use library resources, but also to publicize their research and share their information with policymakers. We've been thinking a lot about how we can enable more digital scholarship type of research, more digital humanities, and we've engaged with two outside experts, Dan Shenhoff, whose name has already come up, and Michelle Gallinger, to write a report about infrastructure that might be necessary and things like that. And following that, we'd like to do a small-scale implementation just as a proof of concept. We've started a library innovation fellowship this year. So we have selected two candidates who are charged with doing something innovative and interesting with the digital collections. We hope to advertise it a little more widely in future years. Biking will not be required. That's just a very good coincidence. So if you're more of a walker or a driver, it's kind of fun. And the last thing is we just hosted this big event, Collections of Data. Laura and Matt were there. It was really fun, and it was really great. The live stream, the video from the live stream is online, so if you have you're doing something, manual data entry at your desk, I encourage you to check it out. All the speakers were great. They were just phenomenal. But it explored the contours of how we can use our collections as data, and we intentionally broadened it from digital humanities. We want to include all walks of digital scholarship, including social science, but the ethical challenges, the technological challenges, was a really great event. So, I'm going to pivot a little bit. How's the pace?
Fine.
How many left? Anybody know how many left? I'm not talking myself. I'll just keep talking until they stop. So, I think Edward can attest that I handed him my slides before I came here, right? Okay, because I feel like I'm doing a little bit of cold reading, like there's a lot of themes that have come up over the last couple of days that are in here, and I really don't want anything of copying anybody, okay? But it's neat, and there's some fun things that come up again and again, and I really encourage you, if you're ever going to get a talk, just go first. So, as you might imagine, I think a lot about the tension between innovation and sustainability. I think about how, I like to say that the Library of Congress was in the building carved out of marble by revolutionaries, that we've been doing innovation and sustainability for a long time, but there's this perceived tension there. And how can libraries maintain the qualities that make them endure, but still be agile and innovative? And in that way, I think we're natural partners with news, which has a bias in sort of the opposite direction. News, for the most part, is not dominated by the sort of large, sustained, durable organizations that we serve today, right? They're dominated by small, agile, kind of fleeting organizations. The bad news is community news is dying. right? But the good news is, it always has been. The American is littered with the death of small papers. So, this is not new. We can do this, right? So, I realize this is obvious to all of you because you're here, but I'm going to get into the meat of my talk now, which is emerging partnerships, historic partnerships, emerging standards, and new opportunities. Thinking specifically about the Library of Congress, we have a different relationship with printers than most institutions, obviously, through the mandatory copyright deposit. And it's commemorated in the beautiful Jefferson Building here at the SGS. If you're ever in D.C., please stop by. I think it's the prettiest space in Washington. we have this long historic partnership that has endured many changes in copyright laws. And that legal relationship has created personal relationships that have resulted in other adjacent goods. For example, when the Washington Post recently moved buildings, they donated some print material to us that was outside of the copyright law. But I think we need to figure out how to maintain those relationships in the digital world where we're not tied by those same rules. I also want to mention that we are doing a pilot with the news, some news media lines, formerly NAA, to test the technological ability of the library to access and for them to create e-prints, which is alternative to microfilm. So that's going on right now. We're working with Gannett, with the New York Times, with the Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal, which is exciting. I'm going to talk for a second about the National Digital Newspaper Program. This is not online news, it's like the opposite of online news. But I think it's cool for two reasons. One is to show, to really, like, you all know the importance of getting news because like you travel here and you're sitting in these comfortable chairs and during my talk. But it's nice to have tangible examples that you can use to talk to other people. And we can look to our history to have those. And the other is to show this historic partnership and the other benefits it has had outside of its products. So the National Digital Newspaper Program is a historic partnership between the Library of Congress and NEH and hundreds of state partners all around the country to digitize historic newspapers, which are ingested at the Library of Congress and provided at chroniclingamerica.org. It's really neat, and I think one of the cool things that you find out of these historic archives are very personal. So people use these for personal ancestry and family trees, but also some really really cool academic research comes out of it. NEH recently issued a data challenge where they gave some prize money to people doing digital humanities style research with the raw OCR that we make available. And this is one of the really interesting projects that came out of it. So Lincoln Mulligan, who's a researcher at GW, did some text analysis around Bible verses and showed what Bible verses were being used at what time, tracked them over time, and which ones were adjacent. And I think this is really interesting because it shows the kind of knowledge that we would never have had if we hadn't preserved these newspapers. But also, it's the sort of research that is not directly competing with the use of those newspapers. So it's almost secondary knowledge in that way. So I want to talk a little bit about push versus pull. And we talk about a lot of the Library of Congress, like what should our mode of getting material be in the future? It used to be that we just opened the loading dock and things came, right? So that's like a pull model. The digital world is a little bit different for various reasons. And I think when we're talking about the current state of the art in preserving online news, most of what we're doing is pulling. So I think most of what is actually happening right now is through web archiving. So as most of you know, the Library of Congress is a very large web archiving program. We archive a lot of board digital news sites, so sites that don't have a print surrogate or whose print surrogate is kind of secondary. So examples of these are Verge, Vox, Salon, The Daily Beast, And these are sprawling sites. You know, you think about BuzzFeed and how big it is. We try to crawl those regularly and really in depth. But what we miss when we do that is the stuff that goes fast, right? An approach that we're taking recently is using RSS feeds. This was pioneered by the Icelandic National Library. And what that allows us to do is get the stuff that's brand new right away. So we're doing a very shallow crawl using RSS feed, and a deep crawl using the site. I mention this because RSS is a standard, not a new standard, but I think it's kind of a new application of it in the way that I think we do it. The next standard I want to talk about is IIIF. Who here has heard of IIIF? Who here knows what it is? Okay, I feel like that's actually way more than I thought. I really encourage you to check out the talk Everything You Always Wanted to Know About IIIF or Afraid to Ask from DPLA. The news folks gave us web developers in libraries Django, right? Like Django is hugely used in libraries, and it came out of news. I think this is a thing that we can give news folks. Like this is, if you're ever looking to replace your Tile server, check out IIIF. It's a really cool standard that allows you to use an API to request different size images, to request metadata. What it was intended for was to enable annotation and shared image viewers, but that's not really important today. What's important today is what it gets us in terms of integrating libraries and news, which is virtual repatriation. So what we can do is use our viewer to show an image from the news site, giving them the hit, which may or may not be important, but it's just one more tool in our toolbox. The other thing that it gives us is structured URLs, which enter an agreement with a news organization to ingest their site, that's a thing that we can use to get the images in a way that is automated. I don't know of any adoption in the news community of this, but I do know JuxtaposeJS, which is an image viewer that you can use to compare images, is very similar, or shares a lot of features in common with Mirador. There's definitely some mutual interest here that I think might be worth exploring. StoryCorps. Who here's heard of StoryCorps? Okay, great. That's perfect. I'll just play it. you may have heard that StoryCorps recently got some money to make a mobile app. You haven't downloaded it. You should. It's really cool. You can experience the StoryCorps experience at like your Thanksgiving table and capture the oral histories of your loved ones from the comfort of your own home. When they started building their app, they engaged with us at the Library of Congress to figure out a way to archive that. So we worked with them to develop their API, which is public, and we are using that. We're using a script to ingest that that content into the library and preserve it. So we wrote an iPress paper. If you're interested in learning more, you can check that out. One of the really interesting things about engaging with this, and this is kind of news adjacent, right? So StoryCorps ends up on NPR, which is news, but I think the technical parallels are very similar. One of the interesting things was in working with them, talking about checksums and fixity was so foreign to them. So they kept talking about their API as a stream, right? And we don't think of it that way, right? We need discrete chunks that are frozen in time. And, making decisions about were we going to take comments, were we going to take likes, were we going to take metadata, how final is final, when things get tagged, you know, so there's like a distribution of times where, like, when a new thing is published, it gets tagged, like, where's the sweet spot in which we should take it. So that kind of conversation is really interesting, and, the mutually beneficial relationship between the two groups was kind of neat to explore. Okay. I like to think about how we can encourage media organizations to donate their back catalogs or sell. Because, as you heard, like in the print world, we didn't get this for free either, right? And I think that there are, and how can we encourage libraries to accept this? Because there are technical hurdles there, too. Let's start with publishers. I think one of the ways that we can encourage more publishers to donate or sell their back catalog is to talk about the scholarly use of this material and explain that it doesn't really conflict with regular readership. So we do this all the time in our manuscript collections, right? We take people's manuscript collections, which are of value to them. We take them into libraries and we make gift agreements that you know, place a box around that you're not opening up to the world. And I think having some sample gift agreements before we start the conversation with publishers could really be useful. I think there's also in libraries, from the library side, can be a little bit of a cultural issue too. So we're looking at Wired later on how to use Snapchat, which is a toy for children. And when you think about the news that we all read, it's just getting increasingly more fractured, right? There are some things that we all experience, right? Everybody in Washington reads the Washington Post. But lots of people in Washington read Wonkette and 538, and lots of people in Washington don't know what those are, right? So that's becoming more and more true. And I don't really have a solution for this yet, that when you're talking to you know, your acquisitions folks, explaining to them what the cultural significance of some of this material is, but I think it's an interesting challenge. In terms of technological challenges, the New York Times talked about their data migration, and you heard how hard it is. Anybody who's gone through it once does not want to do it again. But in libraries, what we're talking about is doing that 100 times, 1,000 times, 100,000 times, right? If we're going to take these archives on, it's not really scalable. So we've got to think of some alternate ways of taking this material in. And we need to think about ways to take this material in that make it usable. Libraries are not a hole for dropping books in, and they're not a hole for dropping data in either, right? We want to preserve this to make it useful. And I've got a couple of, I think, ways that we could... a couple of ways that we can think about making that doable. One is to put Jupyter Notebooks on top of raw database dumps. So thinking about making this material available to researchers who are using digital humanities and data style research. I think Jupyter Notebooks are a really fun way to do that. It tricks people who are afraid of code into coding, right? You could be like, if you're afraid of code, just type things into this web page. I wish I had more time to talk to you about that, but I don't. Another thing is to rely on virtualized hosting. So we do this a lot now with our scholarly articles. The Library of Congress will accept an archive and we'll preserve it. We make it actually available to our researchers through database subscriptions. And similarly, if there's a media organization that was filling out a business or wanted to send their archive to us, what we could do is host it on a virtual server and ingest it, and that way we can provide access in a usable form. And the last thing I want to talk about is the importance of friendship. Tech folks in libraries and tech folks in news share a lot in common. We use really similar stacks in some cases, the same exact web frameworks. I spend a lot of my time on Twitter. A lot of my Twitter friends that I hang out with are from news organizations, just because we have the same kinds of problems. We have large back catalogs we want to leverage. We have, same problems of print in the digital and the print world, or print in the digital world, and the same kind of skill issues, right? We're basically physicists in the 50s in libraries, right? Like, it's not enough to know physics. You have to learn how to write code. You have to learn how to use technology. Making friends, I think, is really good. Talking to journalists at the one-on-one level. Recognizing that working together is like a muscle. So the more cooperative projects we do, the easier it is to do more of them. That's it. Thank you.
Maybe one question, yeah, we're Sure. Our students here. Tamar?
Thank you. Thanks very much for your talk. I really enjoyed that. And I'm going to apologize to everyone in the room in case, as someone who's new to library studies, I'm asking something obvious. But you mentioned that a lot of your emphasis has been on web archiving, and I'm wondering if the way that we, at least I, as a layman, typically conceive of news archives and doing research in news archives, where I'm going into LexisNexis or something like that, and everything's in text, it's all text, and it all looks the same, it's all the same format. Is that an outmoded way of thinking about news archives? Are we moving towards a day where it's all just, going to be completely preserved web pages? No?
I meant that not from the library's perspective, but from the field. I think what most libraries are doing to preserve news is doing web archives. But I mean, what from Lexis is great. I think that's not ever going to go away. I don't think it's outmoded. And in fact, the normalization that some of those vendors do help us, make sense of it over time. It doesn't really lend itself to the kind of text analysis or visualization that I think a lot of scholars want to do today. So I don't know. I think that someone asked the New York Times folks the same question earlier, and I think that's really an interesting angle to think about.
I think we have to cut it off. I'm sorry. The time that the schedule we have today, we need to move on. Thank you, Kay.
Thank you.
So, very briefly, it is